Well, good morning, Ian. I hope your conference cold is recovering as the conferences disappear behind us into the rearview mirror. Although, I think the S&P's have still got theirs, but I'm not intending we should spend too long on that. But we might possibly review how the conferences have gone for everybody.
I think we probably should. I only went to one of them this year, which I normally go to, the Labour one too, but made do with just the Tory one. I got invited by Andrew Marshall to go on the paper review this morning, which I was quite happy to do. And then they told me it was going to be in Glasgow at the SNP conference. And I thought, I just can't. I mean, a whole weekend basically ruined just for 10 minutes on television. And I was coming to Norfolk anyway, so I thought, no. I think the SNP can do without me.
They'll survive. Well, you're in demand. They wanted you last week as well, didn't they? But you turned them down for Sophie Ridge and me.
Well, I did, because I'd already said I would do Sophie Ridge. And one rule I have is if you get invited onto one programme and then a better offer comes along, you don't ditch the original, because I think that's really bad, because I was brought up to be polite.
You're a man of your word.
I am indeed. So let's go through what we're going to be talking about. As you said, we're going to do a bit of a conference review. We'll talk about the latest developments in the Salisbury incident. Brett Kavanaugh has now been confirmed as a Supreme Court Justice. I want to talk about jazz hands, the Nobel Peace Prize, my little car crash this week. It was a very little one, it has to be said. And we'll answer your questions as well. So it was your first time at a Conservative conference. You basically couldn't wait to leave, could you?
Well, somebody asked us, would I like to give my view of the Conservative Party conference, because I'd been. But it would be fair to say it was somewhat of a flying visit. So I arrived at about 8 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, and I was out the door by 11 after we'd recorded the podcast.
It wasn't, because that went well, didn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Can you
explain
believe
to our
it?
Listeners why they were shortchanged?
Well, as most of you know, when we record this, we're not in a studio. I'm in my house and you're in yours. And we have never, ever done a podcast where about 20 minutes has had to be deleted. So we were on the LBC stand with a professional sound engineer last week. And I thought we did a cracking podcast. We did a bit longer than we normally do. And I was being quite revelatory about something. And 20 minutes had to be cut out because your microphone was down. I'm thinking, how can that be when you have a sound engineer? I said, well, why did that happen? And he said, well, it sounded all right from my end. And I said, well, it clearly wasn't. So how can you not notice that a microphone isn't working? Still haven't had an explanation. So I was a bit hacked off about that.
And I think you're right. It was really good, actually, I thought, last week's. But there we go.
I mean, I'm not sure we can really reprise it, can we? Mainly because I can't
bloody remember, you know.
I think one of the bits was me nearly being raped, but nobody wants to hear about that, do they?
That was really, it was revealing from you, and it was really moving.
A bit too revealing. Maybe there wasn't a problem with the microphone. Maybe they just thought that the listeners didn't want to hear about my sexual escapades, which you can understand, let's face it.
I think we will reprieve it at some point or another, that
though. Maybe not today, though. Now, so let's look back at the conferences. I think it was a bit of a meh season. Nothing happened. It was all a bit boring. Can you even remember that the Lib Dem conference took place?
Yes, of course I can, because Vince Cable had an exotic spresm.
Wasn't it supposed to be an erotic spasm?
It was, but something happened. Something erotic obviously didn't happen, so it had to become exotic. You're right, there wasn't an awful lot of action going on. If he hadn't done that, we probably would not have noticed that it had happened at all. But then Labour had their conference, and we talked a bit about this last week, and on the whole, well, it was at least an opportunity for Labour to move on from a pretty difficult summer of anti-Semitism allegations and concern about what they were doing about Brexit, to express a wide range of views about Brexit, but also to do some other sort of slightly more interesting policy announcements and discussions. So I think it was a sort of one tick for Labour, I would give them.
I thought it was a very interesting way of deflecting the anti-Semitism row for Jeremy Corbyn to praise an anti-Semite in his lead speech, but there we go. Takes all sorts, I suppose, doesn't it? I mean, honestly. I don't really disagree with any of that. I've just thought of something that happened at the Lib Dem conference.
Oh.
The launch of the movement of moderates.
Oh, yes. If you want a name to sort of stir the loin, movement of moderates is not really it, is it?
Don't keep making me laugh because it makes me cough.
I'm sorry.
See, having got rid of my hiatus hernia cough, I now have another cough, but this is a very different one, a sort of coldy, chesty cough, which it makes me sound as if I smoke 40 a day, which is not a pleasant sound.
No, it isn't. But it does remind me, listeners, public service announcement, that if you are eligible for a flu jab, you should have one. I will be having one next week.
Yeah, because we've reached that age, haven't we? Well, I have one. I get one anyway because I'm a diabetic. But
because I'm an asthmatic, but I get one at the hospital where we've got a target to make sure that we get, I think it's this year, it's over 75% of our staff with flu jabs.
I hope you don't queue jump.
I have it done with a photo taken of me because this is in some way supposed to encourage others to do it. But of course, these photos have become rather notorious because you remember Dan Poulter, the health minister. He had a photo taken of himself having a flu jab, and for some reason or another, he felt it necessary to take his shirt off. So it's a sort of, he's not a bad looking guy, but you've got this photo of him sort of topless having his flu jab, which means the rest of us, when we have our photos done, feel slightly nervous about quite how many clothes we need to take off.
So you're not going topless, you mean?
Perhaps I will, if that encourages more people to have their jabs, Ian.
Do you think it would? It might encourage other people to have a different kind of jab, but...
Oh, did I feel a prick?
Wouldn't be the first time. How did we get onto that? I have to say, I can highly recommend Lemsip Max, the pills. They really... Because on Thursday, I thought I was going... Was it Thursday? No, it wasn't. It was Wednesday. I thought I was going to have to leave the show early because I just felt so rough in the afternoon. Had I not been doing Cross Question that evening, I would have missed the whole programme, I think. And then Jacob, my producer, gave me some Lemsip Max, and that had an absolutely transformational effect. So I didn't have to leave the show early, and Tom Swarbrick got off doing an extra hour.
For the many podcasts sponsored by Lemsip Max...
Actually, we could do with a sponsor, couldn't we?
Who do you think we should have?
Viagra.
Well, given, as you say, given our age, we need something like, do you remember that Synatogen tonic wine?
Tenor lady.
Tenor man as well, so shut up.
I am serious, though, because we have got a bite of possibly a sponsor, so... But I can't reveal anything at the moment.
Because it isn't Tenor Lady.
It isn't Tenor Lady. So, but if any listeners work for a company that would like to sponsor us, I'm sure it's very cheap. You're like us, really. Anyway,
gratuitous advertising for the first 10 minutes of it.
We haven't got to the bit where we're supposed to be funny yet, have we? So let's talk about Russia. You wanted to talk about Russia. What did you want to talk about?
Well, I just thought it was worthwhile sort of reviewing the fact that this week, interestingly, it came up because we of course did Good Morning Britain on Friday, and quite unusually, every single front page, of course, had a photo of the, didn't it? Every single front page had a photo of the Russians who had been unmasked, and the four particularly who had been caught in The Hague back in April, essentially trying to listen in to the chemical weapons investigators as they were carrying out the investigation into the Salisbury attack. And they were... they were deported by the Dutch. And interestingly, there's some discussion in the papers today about whether or not they should have been arrested, but the Dutch basically just sent them home to Russia. And this is just the sort of latest in what is now appearing to be a sort of series of chapters of incompetence on the part of the Russian intelligence agencies, which on the whole have got a good record. Well, good record. They are experienced at carrying out this type of espionage. And I think Putin must be getting a little bit sick and tired now of them being slightly ridiculed in the way in which they've been acting and behaving.
Well, I think that's right. The only thing I would say about this particular incident is this is kind of what security services do. It's, I'm sure, what MI6 do from time to time, just as the CIA do. So although there's been a lot of huffing and puffing about how outrageous it is, and I suppose in a way, obviously it is, but it is the sort of thing you expect your foreign security services to do. Now, that's not saying it's right, it's just recognising reality and the fact that we no doubt do it as well. It's not the same as what happened in Salisbury.
But no, it isn't. But of course, if they hadn't been responsible for what happened in Salisbury, why would they have been bothered about the investigation that was being carried out find out who was responsible? So it sort of slightly points the finger at them, I have to say, that they were that bothered.
And the Russians still haven't accepted that this guy Chapiga is the same man that was in Salisbury, which I suppose, again, you don't expect them to do. But their excuses are really running out of rope here, aren't they? And you're right, they are being ridiculed for their complete lack of competence in both of these operations.
But bizarrely, they still have supporters. I forced myself to watch a clip this morning of George Galloway on Russia Today.
Oh, don't.
I mean, what unbelievable that he can be on there. I mean, obviously he's been paid a large amount of money to go on Russia Today and rubbish the organisation who actually did the investigative reporting and who apparently are going to name the other one next week as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and during the course of this, of course, so he's on Russia Today, and during the course of it, he calls the BBC the state-run British Broadcasting Authority. Now, you know, we may have criticisms of the BBC, you probably more than me, but they are not run by the state. They are explicitly set up to be independent from that sort of political interference.
But I imagine when you were Home Secretary, you'd have quite liked them to be run by the state.
I don't know what you're suggesting about my authoritarian tendencies, but the point was, as we all know, they take an independent and neutral position, frustratingly so sometimes. And actually, George Galloway is a bit of a bloody disgrace, one, to be on Russia Today, and two, to be trashing his own national broadcasting company. But then why would I be at all surprised by that?
The problem is, it does have an effect, as I know from the many listeners that phone in taking Russia's side on this. I was hoping to do an hour with Mark Urban on my programme today, the Newsnight diplomatic editor. He's written a book all about Salisbury, and he's actually met Mr. Skripal. And it is absolutely fascinating. And I wanted him to come on, not just to do an interview, but to take calls from these conspiracy theorists, traitorous, quizzling lunatics that phone in and take Russia's side, because he would be able to absolutely demolish every single argument that they put forward. I mean, I try my best and I do it. But I mean, he has a huge amount of knowledge about what happened on this, far more than I could ever have.
Is he going to do it? Is he going to be on the programme?
Well, I'm hoping he's going to come on Tuesday week on the Tuesday interview slot, where we can have someone on for an hour. We've got Andrea Leadsom this week, by the way.
Oh, right.
So, well, I'm just saying, if you wish to tune in, we have Andrea Leadsom.
Did you hear the enthusiasm in my voice?
I didn't. I never quite understood this thing about people are really anti-Andrea Leadsom. She's one of the nicest people in politics.
I think the thing still hangs over her about when she, in her leadership campaign, about the I'm a mother,
yeah.
I.e. Theresa May, you're not. And I thought that was pretty despicable, really. So she went down in my estimation.
Do you think it was intentional?
I think it was, yeah. Let's be fair. All of us who are parents probably at some point or another during election campaigns have used that in some way. So, you know, I certainly used to say in Redditch, my children were born in the local hospital. So to that extent, I was using the fact that I was a mother for my political advantage. But what I wasn't doing was saying, in the way that it felt that she was, that I have a better understanding of the priorities and the future of this country because I'm a mother and you, Theresa May, aren't. That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, see, I know exactly what you mean. I don't think she did mean it like that. Maybe we'll go through that on Tuesday. Maybe we won't. I don't know. Now, let's move on. I was watching Sky News yesterday, all the coverage of the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation. I genuinely, earlier in the week, couldn't see any way that he would be confirmed. He was 50 to 48. There was lots of disruption in the gallery. I don't know. And the vice president who presides over the Senate kept telling the sergeant at arms to restore order, which he clearly couldn't do. I say he. I'm assuming it's he. I don't know. Why are they ought to just clear the gallery, I would have thought. But this is going to have reverberations for years to come, I think, don't you?
I think it probably is. I mean, I thought when they agreed to an FBI investigation that they would never get to the point where they could confirm Kavanaugh. I hoped they would never get to the point where they could confirm him. But of course, they conceded that, but then they made it so narrow that it was practically impossible in a week to find any sort of corroborating evidence. And frankly, I think there were people willing to confirm him even if they suspected that it was true. And you know, you heard members of the public saying things like, in fact, Isabel Oakeshott tweeted, which I was sort of pretty disappointed about, you know, that just because you do something foolish in your youth, it shouldn't stop you from being able to be a Supreme Court justice. Well, you know, actually, not only was what he was accused of pretty serious, but actually I thought the way that he responded in an extremely partisan way and making veiled threats to those who he claimed had brought these charges upon him made him unsuitable for that role, which of course, although we know is more political than a UK Supreme Court judge would be, nevertheless shouldn't be taken by somebody who becomes so hysterical under questioning and who makes threats to political opponents. That I think it will have repercussions in his ongoing credibility or lack of it as a justice, although it's a job for life, so in some ways does that matter. It may have implications in terms of the way that people vote in the midterm elections, although, of course, on the whole, what it appears to have done is to once again strengthen Trump's support amongst his core vote, who, it's a hideous thing to say, seem to like that sort of awful, you know, let's not forget also this week, he did the most disgusting criticism, mockery of Blasey Ford's description of what had happened to her. And, you know, I thought that was absolutely disgusting. But he clearly thinks that that's going to play to his supporters. And in fact, whilst he was doing it, people behind him were clapping and laughing, which is, yeah, I just think, you know, appalling. And lots of women, and I think men as well, feel this is a pretty nasty backlash, actually, against women that's going on in the States at the moment.
Well, I played that clip out on my show and called it on air disgusting. And you should have seen the abuse I then got on Twitter and text and email because I had called it disgusting. I mean, there are some warped people out there. People who think that they are Christians, people who think that they are moral people, they will support the President of the United States when he does that sort of thing. And this is what gets me. I don't understand. In America, these evangelical Christians who ought to disapprove of behaviour, both of Brett Kavanaugh, I mean, let's assume that there is some truth into it. They ought to be, if you're a Christian, surely you can't approve of that sort of thing. And you surely can't approve of your president uttering those kind of words. And yet these people are his strongest supporters. There is a huge amount of hypocrisy in evangelical Christianity, in my view.
There is indeed quite a few of the other views that they hold on equal marriage, on women's rights to control their own bodies, are far from what you would hope would be a sort of tolerant Christian approach to...
They might be, but on those two issues, at least I can understand their logic from the scriptures and all the rest of it. I might disagree with it, but at least I can have some basic understanding of it. On this issue, I have no understanding of it.
To ridicule the weak and a potential... You're right that if you believe her or not, to ridicule somebody who is coming forward with an to talk about an allegation of sexual assault is a shocking thing to do.
And let's put it this way. This woman, from everything that I can see, is a completely credible witness, something Donald Trump even himself apparently said initially. She's not Stormy Daniels, who one could... I mean, I saw an interview with her on Newsnight on Friday night. Well, I could say a lot about that. But she's not that kind of person.
Yeah, but he did it, though. He did it, though, didn't he? I mean, she might not be a very prepossessing woman, but he did it, didn't he?
I'm sure he did, but that's what I'm saying. She's a professor, for goodness sake. Now, I'm sure there are bad professors. I'm sure there are professors that do terrible things, but sometimes you can just see if somebody is telling the truth as she sees it. And I mean, it may well be that it may possibly be that it was a case of misidentification. I suspect we'll never know. And Trump, you're not going to like this, but Trump did have a point in some of the things he was saying, but it was the way he said them. I mean, saying that she couldn't recall this, couldn't recall that. Well, that is a perfectly proper thing for, like, a barrister in a court of law to point out, but you do it in a way that is not insulting to the witness, because I mean, I don't know about you, but I couldn't remember what I was doing 35 years ago on a particular day in a particular place.
Except on quite a few of those things, she actually had given details. So he lied about what she hadn't given details about. But she had got quite a few of those details. She did know where it was. She did know it was upstairs. She did know details about what had happened. So he was lying about what she knew, what she had said and what she hadn't said, to undermine her for political purposes. It's utterly despicable, and it will have long-term impacts on whether or not women feel able to come forward to report attacks like that, and actually what women feel about those that are representing them in the Senate as well, and men as well. Decent people, essentially.
Well, let's move on to have a little word about Brexit. We have Donald Tusk trolling Theresa May again in a tweet, basically saying, well, we've had Canada plus on offer right from the beginning. It's still on offer. Now, to my mind, he did that to stir it up with Theresa May and the Conservative Party. There is no other explanation, in my view. Now, I would happily do a Canada plus deal, but when you know the Prime Minister has expressly ruled it out and said it would be worse than a no deal, why would you do that if you're the President of the European Council?
I don't know where we are on these negotiations at the moment. Presumably not a lot has happened during the course of the Conservative Party conference, and even in previous weeks from what I can see. But isn't Michel Barnier this morning saying that he's expecting the UK to come forward with new proposals on the Irish border and trying once again to be reasonably positive, I think, about wanting to engage with that?
Well, I think it's not unknown that the British government is going to come forward with proposals on that. They always said they would do around this time. My fear is that the front page of, was it Tuesday's or Wednesday's Times, will prove correct, and Theresa May is going to suggest staying in the customs union for God knows how long. If she does that...
And this is the reason why she feels able to call for Labour votes to get the deal through. But frankly, Ian, if she can't find a way to get Labour to vote with her, she's not going to get the deal through Parliament anyway, is she?
Well, you say that. I've never been completely convinced of that, because I think there wouldn't be very many Conservative MPs that vote against it. I mean, OK, everyone has their limits. If she proposed staying permanently in the customs union, I think many Conservative MPs, that would be regarded as a red line. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. But I fear that what they come up with is going to be music to the ears of the EU, but maybe not to a lot of people who voted for Brexit. But we'll see.
But doesn't she feel possibly emboldened now by the good reaction that she got to her speech? Because we haven't really talked about the Conservative Party conference yet. And, you know, remember, she went into this conference with everybody saying, is she going to hang on? What's going to be the impact of Boris's speech? Are people plotting against her? Who's going to be the next leader? She comes out at the end with a certain amount of ridicule about the dancing, but also a certain amount of respect for still being there and able to deliver what was seen as a sort of pretty proficient speech. Well, you know, nothing fell off the wall behind her and she didn't get overtaken by a cough. But it was even slightly better than that, I think.
Yes, I think it was. I actually thought that it was probably the best leader's speech I've heard at a Tory conference since the days of William Hague. I thought it was an absolutely brilliant speech, partly because it covered all bases, which often the commentators say, well, you didn't mention this or you didn't mention that. Well, she did cover all bases, I think. She was perfectly reasonable in what she said. There was a bit of meat in the speech, which, let's face it, there wasn't in most of the cabinet minister speeches at the Tory conference. She delivered it well. Her timing was excellent. I'm told several of the jokes that went down best were actually her own jokes, that she came up with them. We'll never know how true that is, but that's what I'm told. The dancing thing was not rehearsed. They told her they were going to play Dancing Queen. And then she spontaneously, apparently, did the rather... Because let's face it, if she'd rehearsed it... if she'd rehearsed it, it might have been a bit more coordinated. But that, in a sense, was the whole point. We all know that she's awkward, and sometimes it's a good thing to play up to your stereotypes. I mean, Margaret Thatcher used to do that all the time. And I mean, she was much more pragmatic than she made out. But the whole sort of conviction politician, the Iron Lady thing, just suited her image down to the ground. So she played up to it. And I think Theresa May is slightly playing up to the fact that we all know she's a bit socially awkward.
It's really interesting because I work in, you know, all the places I work, people are probably on the whole more left-leaning than right-leaning. And the consensus amongst the people that I was listening to on Wednesday about the dancing was... and I don't think they were Conservative supporters, was, oh, well, you know, good on her, she's owned it, and, you know, fair enough. And I think it's a bit like when John Prescott lamped that bloke. I think people sort of think, oh, well, that's, you know, that's what a normal person would do. Or, you know, that's got a bit of chutzpah about it, and we like that. And it sort of cuts through, I think, in a way that probably any of the policies she announced wouldn't have done. So to that extent, I think it was a success for her.
I can't remember whether it was on the podcast or whether it was on my radio show that I predicted she would actually do that, come onto the stage and dance. I didn't predict Dancing Queen, but I certainly predicted that. That was one of the options that she had to try and own it. So I'm going to take full credit for it.
Okay, well done. What would have been your track?
Probably from The Greatest Showman, This Is Me.
You love that film, don't you?
I do. And do you know what?
I'm going to have to watch it.
The people that wrote it, that wrote the music in it, they wrote another musical, which has been an absolute hit on Broadway, called Dear Evan Hansen. And that's coming to London in November. Is it the Noel Coward Theatre, I think? Which I'm very, very excited by, because all of the tracks, frankly, could be from The Greatest Showman. They are very, very similar.
I saw your tweet about it, so...
Well, it's very, very, very exciting, I think. You wanted to talk about the Nobel Peace Prize, which astonishingly didn't go to Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump.
This also came up on our appearance on Good Morning Britain on Friday. And I think actually you and I were probably both wrong, and we were led astray by the suggestion the favourite to receive the Nobel Peace Prize was Donald Trump. And if it wasn't Donald Trump, it was probably going to be Kim Jong-un and the South Korean leader. And in the end, of course, it went. And you and I said, oh, well, you know, this is a sign that the Peace Prize is really pretty well undermined, because, you know, our view was that it probably shouldn't have gone to Barack Obama so early on in his time either. But in actual fact, of course, it went to two people, a Yazidi woman and a Congolese gynecologist, who not together but separately have carried out the most amazingly brave work against sexual assault and rape being used as part of part of the way in which you prosecute a war. And in particular, the woman, Murad is her surname, had been herself a victim of trafficking and slavery and sexual assault by IS, and had then nevertheless come through that and been willing to publicly take a role and act as an ambassador and to campaign against it. These people are phenomenally brave and raising an issue which is one of the most disgusting aspects of some of the conflicts around the world, and they thoroughly deserved it, and well done Nobel Peace Prize for having chosen them.
Well, can you imagine the outcry there would have been if Donald Trump had been given a peace prize? I mean, if it comes off and there is some sort of proper nuclear deal with North Korea, then I think there would be a case for that, but certainly not yet.
No. I mean, I would find it hard for him ever to have a peace prize, but it would have been ludicrous for him to have one at the moment, you're right.
Have you ever had a car crash?
Do you know? I think
I don't mean a political one either.
Oh, you're hilarious. What, like a speech or a TV appearance?
Yeah.
No, the last car crash I had actually happened at the Palace of Westminster when I was turning right into Derby Gate, I think it is, and I turned across traffic and a moped came up the inside and smashed into the side of me. And I think it was my fault. I had to answer lots of questions anyway. And I tell you, I thought this guy, in fact, he was not seriously injured, but I thought I had killed him, and it was absolutely awful. I just sat paralysed in the car. And funnily enough, it was Paul Keach, the MP for Hereford, the Lib Dem MP for Hereford, who very sadly died last year, I think it was, who came and got me out of the car and took me off somewhere and sat me down and just treated me incredibly kindly. But that was absolutely hideous. But I think that's the last crash that I had, because I am an excellent driver, Ian. Whereas you, of course.
Yes, well, I had a little prang on Thursday night. It wasn't a crash, but I was in the car park by Leicester Square because I brought my car in because I thought, well, after Good Morning Britain on Friday, I could then drive to Norfolk so I could have a proper 3.5 day weekend being greedy. So I parked in the car park in Leicester Square, which I park in a lot, but the top of it was cordoned off, so I had to go underground, which I'd never been in that bit before. So I parked and then went off, and then when I came back after the show on Thursday night, I put the car into reverse and swung left, as you would do, because I'd gone in front first, not realising...
Generally a good thing to do, Ian.
Yeah. Stop it. Not realising that there wasn't just one concrete pillar, there was another one about 4 feet behind it, and I went straight into the back of it, or the front of it, and there was this terrible crunch, and I actually didn't get out and look at what I'd done. So I didn't actually look until I arrived at the hotel later on. So I think that's probably caused about £1,000 worth of damage. But there we go.
Well, I had a look at it. I had a look at it the following morning. Listeners, we were not spending the night together. We were together at the Good Morning Britain studio. I had a look at it. I didn't think it looked too bad. I think you could just give it... Put a bit of spit on a hanky, give it a bit of a polish up.
Shows how much you know.
It's quite a hefty car you've got there, Ian.
It's a bit of a beast, isn't it? It's a Q7 for anybody that wants to know, and it's black all over, and I love it. Anyway, I have a very similar car crash story to your one, actually, because it involved a motorbike. It was in 1985, and I was at university. It was the day before my finals started. German oral final was the next day, and it was polling day, and I was a candidate in the county council elections, and I was in my Ford Cortina Mark III, a yellow one called the Big
Boy
Banana.
Racer.
Yep. And I was taking three old ladies to vote, and I pulled up to the polling station, put my indicators on to turn right into the polling station, and as I started to turn right, a motorbike overtook me and went straight into the front wing. Oh. And he came like hurtling. I was like a TV thing. He sort of came off the bike, went straight over the bonnet, landed on the road, and broke his leg. And so there was I directing the traffic in my blue Rosette. And I never did discover what happened to the old ladies, but I don't know whether they voted for me or not. But I then found out his identity, which I'm sure the police nowadays wouldn't give you. So he lived on an estate not far from the polling station, so in my electoral ward. So I went round to check that he was okay and walked up to the front door, and there was a vote Labour poster on the front door.
Did you go in? Did you knock?
I won't tell you what went through my mind. I did knock, and he was fine, but did have a broken leg. But I mean, it was completely his fault. It was one of those things where there was no question about it, because there were other people behind me who said, "Yeah, you did indicate." Because of course the police say, "Well, did you indicate?" And I thought, "Well, of course I indicated, but you've got no way of proving that you did." Luckily, a car behind. But I also had a really serious car accident on my 20th birthday when my sisters and I were going to the pub. This was in my orange Ford Cortina Mark III, which, for reasons that you're about to hear, doesn't exist anymore. And we were about 4 miles from our house near Saffron Walden, going off to a pub in Radwinter. And I hit a transit van head on at 50 miles an hour. And this was in the days before seatbelts.
Oh my god,
you have no idea. It was I gripped the steering wheel so hard that it was mangled. My younger sister was sitting in the front. She hit the windscreen and knocked her front teeth out. My other sister in the back, obviously no seatbelt either, hit the back of the other sister's head. And it was really weird, because it was almost like it happened in slow motion, and the three of us could easily have all been killed. There's no doubt about it. The transit van's front, the windscreen fell out. I got out of the car, and both my sisters were obviously sort of screaming. And it was one of those things where you just take control of the situation. And I just said to them, right, stay there, I'm going to go and phone for an ambulance. So I went to the house, got them to phone, came back, and it was just a sort of scene of complete pandemonium. And then about 10 or 20 minutes later, and of course before the days of mobile phones as well, so I had to phone my dad to come. And my dad, for some reason, parked like 100 yards down the road. He was like walking up on the middle of the road with his Wellington boots on, being a farmer. And I just went completely to pieces. And I can just remember sort of crouching down and crying my eyes out. Because I think that was...
Well, it's a horrific shock if something like that happens to you, isn't it?
That was when I realised what had happened. Anyway, I didn't really... I wasn't injured particularly. I had to have a stitch in the back of my head. But my dad made me drive home in his car, can you believe? Because he said, if you don't... Yeah. He said, if you don't do this, you'll never want to drive again. And he was absolutely right. But it was horrific. Anyway, that was all, really. I've had several others, but that was the most dramatic. So,
what's your no claims like? You sound like you're pranging things right, left, and centre.
Well, no, actually, I'm not. I did do another prang when we were on holiday in Spain a couple of years ago. That was in a rental car, though. Luckily, we had paid for all the insurance, which I often don't do, because I always think this is a complete rip off when they say, "Well, do you want this insurance, that insurance?" Yeah. But we did the whole thing, so it's just as well, really. Just a brief word about Globals Make Some Noise, which, if you listen to LBC, I imagine you've heard lots about over the last few days. We do this, and it's a bit like Children in Need. It's to help small charities that otherwise don't really get much attention, and the work they do is absolutely amazing. And this year, I think 2 years ago we raised $2.5 million. Last year it was something over $3 million, and this year it was over £4 million, which I think is an astonishing achievement. So all of the different global stations do this. So you've got LBC, Capital, Heart, Smooth, Goals, Classic FM, Radio X. Have I missed out anyone? Probably. Anyway, they all come together and raise money, and it's sort of not in your face raising money too much, and they sort of auction off different things. Like, you could have lunch with Nigel Farage, which, believe me, the last time I looked,
could I pay a large amount of money not to have lunch with Nigel Farage?
Well, I think they're going to invite you on this lunch, because they raised, last time I looked, I don't know what the final amount was, but it was £9,000.
Paid £9,000 to have lunch with Nigel Farage?
More than that, yeah. So, lunch with me was about 250. Actually, They didn't ask me, because normally what I get like a couple of West Ham director's box tickets or something to auction off, but they, for some reason, they didn't decide not to do that this year and raise money in a different way. So anyway, I wasn't there on Friday because, as you know, I don't work Fridays any longer. But it's, and everyone in the building really gets into the spirit of it, and they dress up in really loud shirts. You can sort of, if you want to read a news bulletin, you can pay £10 and they record it for you. It's all sort of different ways of raising little bits of money. And I remember 2 or 3 years ago, I thought, I've always wanted to do a travel bulletin. So I said to James Rio, right, I'll give you £250 if I can do a travel bulletin. I really wanted to do a news bulletin, but they wouldn't let me do that. So J. Louise Knight wrote a script for me, which I hadn't seen before I read it out on air, and every single place name had a double entendre in it. So on the A131 at Cockermouth... But I just about kept it together. Anyway, this is really just a way of saying to everyone who took part in Make Some Noise this year, well done. And if you want to still donate, because it is such a worthwhile cause, just go to makesomenoise.com.
Shall we do some questions?
I think it's about time that we did.
Quite a serious one from Matthew Holbert, who asks, I think, some very good questions. And this week he says, I'm slowly making my way back to Christian faith. What role, if any, has faith played in your respective politics? Do you agree with Alistair Campbell's maxim that it's best in our secular age for politicians to not do God?
Well, the thing that I think is interesting in that question is the first bit when he says, I'm slowly making my way back to Christianity. So that indicates that he used to be a Christian, went away from it, and is now coming back. Now, I suppose it depends what your definition of being Christian is, because I would say that, and you'll probably agree with this, that my outlook on life is based on sort of Christian tenets, I suppose. I was brought up a Christian. We used to go to church, not every week. I was confirmed in the Church of England, but I have to say I never really believed in God.
Bit of a downer if you want to be a Christian, that one here.
Well, I don't think you have to go to church every week to be, to believe in Christian values.
No, you don't have to go to church, but you see, I'm not one of these people that thinks you can say, well, I'm sort of, you know, I'm Christian, except I don't believe in God. Because that's a sort of fundamental bit of Christianity, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. And from that point of view, clearly, okay, I'm not. I'm an agnostic. I'm not going to say I'm an atheist, because I think atheism is a form of religion, because you have to believe that there is no such thing as God. Well, I don't know whether there is any such thing as God. I don't believe there is. But I can't, hand on heart, say I know, because no one's proved to me one way or the other. I mean, if I had to come down one way or the other, I was on the side of there not being a God. But in a sense, does that really matter? Because it's not about belief necessarily, it's about faith. And people do have faith that there is. I think though, I don't know what people base that on particularly, apart from a sort of 2,000-year-old piece of writing.
This is an interesting question as well, because of course, the relationship to politics. And we were touching on it earlier on in terms of the evangelical churches in the US, who are so far from this understanding that I think surely is fundamental to Christianity about protecting the weak, that actually it's hard to understand how they can square their religious views and their political views. But there are, and also I suppose what you could well say if you were Jewish or if you were Muslim, is that some of those values of service and caring for those who need it are actually pretty universal across religions. So it isn't as if, you know, there is a monopoly of one religion that is likely to have those values. But I think in the UK we tend to be much more careful about very obviously linking our religion with our political position. And to a certain extent, and of course he mentions Alistair Campbell, who said about Tony Blair, that we don't do God. And it wasn't until after Tony finished being the Prime Minister that he felt able to talk about the fact that he'd converted to Catholicism and that actually his faith was important to him. Because we're slightly British about it and we sort of don't want to wear our religious leanings, if we've got them, on our sleeve, or to say that they are influencing our politics. Don't you think that's particularly British, which, given that we've got a sort of established church, is an interesting anomaly in the British system.
Well, it is, and you look at the American system where the state and church are supposed not to come into contact much. It's quite the reverse, and it is an anomaly there. In America, it's very difficult to get elected, I think, in some areas. If you aren't overtly religious, not everywhere, but certainly in a lot of places, I don't want politicians to wear their religious beliefs on their sleeve. I understand why some do. For some people, religion is the most important thing in their life. And so I get why they want to be open about it, and they want to be sort of evangelical about it. Anne Widdecombe, I suppose, comes under that category. But I think normally, I don't think that it's particularly healthy. I mean, religion hasn't really played much role in your political life, has it?
No.
And I think you do believe, whereas I don't.
Yes. I went to a Church of England school, actually, and I was sort of quite...
So did I.
Yeah, hasn't done us a lot of good, has it? I was quite fiercely anti at the time, but I think as I've got older, I have, a bit like Matthew, I suspect, you know, sort of come back towards my Christianity and a Christian faith. Although, having said that, I am neither christened nor confirmed. So
I'm both. Mr. Smith, what were you doing, neglecting your parental duties?
Well, they were, of course, you know, nice liberal parents who said, well, it's up to me to decide what I want to do. But they've now left me. Presumably, if I drop down dead tomorrow, I'm the best that I can expect is purgatory, isn't it?
For so many reasons.
Yeah. I should be down there in the hot bit.
The only time when I've thought I might sort of try and discover my faith was at university, believe it or not. I had quite a few friends who were in the so-called chaplaincy, which I now see has been renamed at UEA the Multi-Faith Centre. How right on of them. And I did go to quite a few events, and there were so many people there that clearly got a lot out of it, and I just couldn't work out why, I suppose. And I really did make quite an effort, but it just... I think it's the logical part of my brain. Even though I'm not at all scientific, I've got no scientific acumen at all, but the logical part of my brain says, well, I can't believe something until I see it, or I somebody proves to me that it exists. And that's really been my stance all along.
Yeah. Whilst we're talking about sort of celestial bodies that some people do and others don't believe in, here is another question. Will you be tuning into Jodie Whittaker's first episode of Doctor Who?
No.
Tonight, because we're doing the podcast on a Sunday.
No, I won't, will you?
Well, I might. I was very moved, actually, surprisingly moved, given that it was Doctor Who, that there is now going to be a woman. So I will probably give it a go, but I have to say, I am a John Pertwee sort of generation of Doctor. So it's all the recent ones have slightly passed me by.
Totally agree. John Pertwee or maybe Tom Baker. And it was really after Tom Baker I lost complete interest in it. And I've never really got into this new incarnation of it. I don't even know who Jodie Whittaker is. I saw her on Graham Norton on Friday night. And I must admit, I never thought I'd hear Doctor Who speak with the Yorkshire accent.
Did you not watch Broadchurch?
No.
She was in... Well, Broadchurch, one, is brilliant, and two, she was in it.
All right, OK.
Which brings me to another question.
Just before you go on that, have you watched Man in the High Castle?
No, I have not. And you keep recommending it, and I haven't watched it.
Well, yesterday, one of my listeners, Martin in Yorkshire, tweeted me to say, you might like to know that the Series 3 has just come on Amazon Prime. So I thought, excellent, that's my Saturday sorted. So I watched four episodes yesterday, and it is superb. For those who don't know about it, it's about as if Germany and Japan had won the Second World War, and they'd carved up America between them. And there's a sort of... Japan has the West Coast states. Germany has virtually all the rest, apart from a strip down the middle through Colorado, which is a neutral zone. And it is the most amazing drama, I think.
Okay, recommendation from Ian. Are you watching Killing Eve?
No.
Which Robin White believes is much better than The Bodyguard.
Well, I think the jury's out on that, because I've seen a lot of people say that they just can't get into it. And then other people say it's the best thing they've ever seen.
I'm into it and I think it's brilliant.
Okay.
But it's quite particular, and I think it would be quite Marmite, I suspect. You would either think it was brilliant or you would hate it.
I have to get into something within the first two episodes, otherwise I give up.
Well, it combines some rather nasty killing with some sex and quite funny, brilliant female characters. So what's not to like there?
Well, indeed.
Oh, let's just redo this one. Did you just hijack... Oh, God, what do I keep telling people? Did you just hijack the For the Many slogan?
Oh, you know, no, we didn't. Jeremy Corbyn hijacked For the Many because it was actually an original Tony Blair slogan, as you will remember, won't you?
I do indeed. I mean, I don't think you could say he used a Labour slogan, but it is interesting, isn't it, that people think that he coined it, when in actual fact it is, I believe, in Clause 4 of the Labour Party's constitution, which, of course, was the Clause 4 that Tony Blair introduced to the party when he became leader, or got the party to support when he became leader. So, but these, honestly, people going saying how outrageous it is. Well, one, we can use whatever bloody slogan stroke title we like, you know.
So fuck off. Side.
Yeah. Two, it's sort of quite ironic and funny, isn't it? So get over it, guys. Yes, we do know where it came from.
I mean, if people knew the trials and tribulations we went through to decide what to call this podcast, I originally wanted to call it Trending, didn't I?
Oh, yes, you did, didn't you? Mm. Yeah. And then we had that... alias or Alas Smith and Dale at one point. We decided that you'd got to be as old as us to understand.
I'd forgotten that. Oh dear. Right, Molesworth says, a female Conservative PM just danced onto the stage at the start of her Set Piece Party conference speech to an ABBA song. Do you consider yourself at the centre of the zeitgeist, and might you think about retiring while at the top? What bloody stupid question. What does that mean?
I don't really know where that was. A complete sort of non sequitur, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But we've already talked about the dancing. Do we consider ourselves at the heart of the zeitgeist? Almost certainly not. But there's enough zeit to follow us and increase the number of people listening to our podcast. And no, I am not yet at the top of my game, so I am not retiring.
I'd love to retire, but I can't afford to.
Now, here's an interesting point, Ian, that you said earlier on. What do you think about the idea? You know, you said, oh, no, and I had a 3.5-day weekend, as if this was somehow or another shameful. There's quite a body of policy and campaigning to get people to think about adopting a 4-day week.
Well, funny enough,
you'll be against that.
No, I have a lot of sympathy with this, purely based on my experience of the last 4 weeks, although I have managed to fill up my Fridays with things, as you can imagine. But I'm not against this, but I don't really see... I mean, it's all very well for Frances O'Grady and the Green Party and whoever and the TUC to say, well, employers can pay the same for 5 days as they... the same for 4 days as they would for five. Well, you've instantly decreased your productivity by 20%, I would have thought, by doing that.
Not necessarily. That's the argument. That's the argument, isn't it? That you don't necessarily decrease your productivity.
No, well, you are going to decrease it. You're not. It may not be by 20%, I'll grant you that. But there are some basic fundamental economic facts here that it does have to be paid for somehow. And while I would say, on the evidence so far, when I go into LBC on a Monday, having had a 3-day weekend, I feel as if I've had a little holiday, to be honest. And that's a good thing, because you're not still a bit tired. Now, that's on a sample of one person. So I'm not sure we're going to get to 4 days a week in most jobs very, very quickly, but I do think that there is a move to much more flexibility in working time, and I think we're seeing that in all sorts of different companies now that actually think that it benefits them to be flexible with their employees. And it does depend on the sector. There are some sectors where you just can't, where everybody does have to be there at the same time, but in a lot of jobs you just don't. And I think a lot of employers are much more trusting of their workforce now, and they allow people to work from home a lot more. And to my mind, if you can't trust somebody to work from home, particularly in a professional environment, why employ them in the first place?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And when I worked in the VTI with Patricia Hewitt as the Secretary of State, that was the point at which we introduced the right to request to work flexibly. And at the time, there was all this sort of, oh, it's a nightmare and it'll increase costs and most people won't be able to do it. But actually, you're right. In most workplaces, it is possible to enable people to work flexibly. You know, as long as people are willing to move, you know, there are people that will do different hours and people are willing to sort of be organised and to negotiate about that. You get far more out of people if they're able to, for example, combine their work with their family caring responsibilities, either for children or older parents, or frankly, if they've just got interests that they want to do other than work. I think people do become more productive. They certainly become more happy. And the research suggests that stress actually at work is more linked to your inability to control your hours and your environment than it is to the number of hours that you work. So, you know, I'm lucky. I work hard, but largely I get to choose what I do and when I do it. And that means that, you know, that is wholly different to somebody who has to religiously turn up at 8 and stay until 5 every day, even if it's only for 4 days, because I get to sort of pick and choose a bit.
Yeah. Sam Amstel, who asks the best questions every week, I think. Who is your favourite currently elected politician? I know what you're going to say.
Do you? What do you think I'm going to say?
Emmanuel Macron.
Oh, gosh, no, I forgot that. Yeah, you're right. That's. I was thinking UK, actually, but no, it would be Emmanuel Macron. I mean, on the whole, we don't have a bumper crop of elected politicians at the moment. We have some good people in the Labour Party. Angela Rayner, who I've talked about previously, Keir Starmer, I think is doing a good job in an absolutely hideous position. But perhaps it's just because we're getting old, we feel that some of the really sort of big characters of former years are not perhaps at the top of our political system at the moment.
It's quite difficult to name a favourite politician. What does that even mean? Does it mean someone you like most?
Yeah. Well, in that case, obviously it would be Caroline Flynn because she's been my mate for years. But, you know, I don't think that was quite what the question was it?
No. I mean, I find that a really difficult one to answer, to be honest, because if I say a politician, then when I next interview them, they say, oh, he's your favourite politician or she's your favourite politician. Mm. So you're going to give them a soft ride. But the thing is, I think that if it's a politician I know and there's a friend, and I do have politicians that are friends, I often give them a harder time than I give other people, and I overcompensate a little bit. I mean, Brandon Lewis will tell you that when he's come into the studio a couple of times, I've given an absolute roasting, and his special advisor was furious with me on one occasion. But
The interesting thing there, Ian, is that he obviously trusts you because he was very open this week, wasn't it, about his dyslexia and how that impacted on him?
Yeah, he came in to do cross question. And of course, on that day, Matt Hancock, the health secretary, had been talking about being dyslexic. And Brandon just texted me and said, oh, by the way, just so you know, I am too. And I said, would you talk about it? So we decided to do an hour's phone on dyslexia after cross question. So he stayed on, which, bearing in mind, that was the day of Theresa May's speech. I mean, he was knackered after that conference, so credit to him for doing that. And he then stayed on after that to listen to one or two of the phone calls. So, and it was really interesting, actually, to hear how somebody at the top of politics has still got there, despite... I said suffering in the hour, and as soon as I said it, sort of suffering from dyslexia, I thought, oh, I suppose that's not allowed, you're not allowed to say that anymore. But apparently all the dyslexic people said, no, it's absolutely fine because it is a condition. That was a very good hour. Martin Sykes, how much do you both get paid? Do you think he means for this podcast, or do you think he means more generally?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, if it's more generally, Martin,
podcast.
Well, thereby hangs a tale. Well, we both get paid the same. Should we just say that? And if he means more generally, more than you could ever dream of, Martin. No, not.
I get paid more than I deserve. No, I don't. But I sort of do, actually. I get paid. Put it this way: I earn more now than I did when I was a cabinet minister.
Well, there you go. She's in the money. So we know what she'd walk out onto stage to. Money, money, money. Whereas I'd walk out to "The Winner Takes It All." Right, a couple of plugs for the other podcasts that I do. The Book Club podcast, which if you haven't downloaded that, please do, because there's some absolute corking interviews on that. This week I talked to Derek Draper, you'll remember him, Jackie, and Max Foster from CNN. Derek has written a book called Create Space, about how we'd be all much more successful if we created space in our lives. It sounds a bit weird, but it's actually a really good book. And Max Foster, my colleague at CNN, he's written a book on cloutology. It's all about how to be successful, and you have to have clout in order to achieve success. I also, on Wednesday afternoon, think about this, I did 3 hours of pre-records. I did an hour with John Simpson and Paddy Ashdown. As you can imagine, I didn't really get a word in edgeways. I then did an hour, half an hour, with Bernard Cornwell, best-selling novelist. He sold 30 million books. And then I did an hour with Kevin Keegan.
I saw your picture.
Oh, do you know, it's really weird when you interview somebody who's been a complete hero over the years, because you don't want to be disappointed, and boy wasn't I disappointed. It was a brilliant hour, so I can't wait till that goes up. So that is the Ian Dale Book Club. Download it on iTunes or Google Podcasts, and then you can get all of these straight to your phone. Cross question this week, we had Brandon Lewis, Andrew Gwynn from Labour. They did put up someone this week, which we were very grateful for. Afua Hirsch and Richard Tice from Leave Means Leave. It's quite a sparky discussion, actually. Really, really interesting one. That's also available on the Cross Question podcast. Next week on Cross Question at 8 o'clock on Wednesday, we have, and I'm doing this from memory, Natalie Bennett, the former leader of the Green Party. We have Camilla Tominey, associate political editor of the Telegraph. We have Nigel Lawson. And ooh, from Labour, we have, well, they say they are actually going to give us a shadow cabinet minister. I've actually booked Wes Streeting, but if they give us a shadow cabinet minister, I'm going to have to postpone Wes, if you're listening, Wes. I'm really sorry, but...
So charming, Wes, eh?
I know. Well, come on. Who would you rather listen to? Wes Streeting or Whispering Barry Gardiner? So, anyway.
Well, Barry's always interesting. You never quite know what's going to...
Exactly. Anyway, I think we'd better finish because we have gone over our time. So download, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. We've had lots of nice messages on iTunes about how much people are enjoying it, particularly the fact that we're so balanced, Jackie, which is interesting.
Chip on both shoulders.
Yeah, quite. So you can get this podcast on any podcast platform. I think 60% of people listen on iTunes. I discovered that the other day. Google Podcasts is coming up on the rails, though. And, of course, my own show on LBC, 7 to 10 p.m., Monday through Thursday. So goodbye from me.
Goodbye. Have a lovely week.
And we're not doing Good Morning Britain for 2 weeks. How will they cope without us?
No, nightmare. So are you doing something nice on Friday?
I'm going to the Midlands, North Midlands, to spend a day with somebody who I'm writing a very long feature on for a national newspaper. But I think they don't want me to tell people that I'm doing this. So no. I better
Mum's
not.
The word.
Mum's the word, yes. So that's what I'm doing next Friday. So you see, again, I've filled up a Friday, so it's still a working day.
Yeah. You are a workaholic, though, because over the weekend you've been setting up Twitter accounts, haven't you, for...
yeah, trolling
all
accounts.
All your podcasts.
Yes, actually.
For all your podcasts, and in fact, for your dogs.
No, my dog one was already there.
Was it?
But I decided to follow you, so you'd follow it back, because I know you like dogs, so... I have created Twitter feeds for Cross Question and the Book Club, because I thought, well, if I that can be just used to sort of promote them, really, and for people who are really into them, I'll put the guests on those before anybody else knows. So if people are still listening, they can go to @question_cross, because I couldn't get Cross Question, or @LBC Book Club. And give us a follow.